I was expecting you to have a follow-up. It's September the 20th, be with you.
Are we going? Are we doing this?
It's September the 20th, be with you, James.
This is the first podcast we've recorded live in I guess, like, what, 3 weeks? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, is that true? I don't know if that's true. 2 weeks?
But it's an interesting statistic.
It is. You know what? This is the 300th podcast that we've recorded.
That's an interesting statistic.
That is.
I like that one. That's a big number.
Yep. Two of the hosts are alive, and one is a ghost.
Wait, is the ghost me?
In fact, it's me, and I haven't realized it yet. And that, from that, I mean, when you think about it, what's so interesting about that statistic is that when you first hear it, you think, oh, Sean's gone. But really, I am the ghost, for I was dead and buried in Shibuya.
All right. I'm guessing there's more to that. Why did you die there?
I was hoping to have Sharonathan on for a more Nihon-centric podcast to really get into the works on what my adventure, my discovery of the land, the far land, the rising sun was. But Shibuya is a magical place where I found a cat that slept underneath Hachiko, and that was adorable. But after a night of drinking in Roppongi that lasted until like 7 a.m., when we were trying to find the way back to a train station, but both Josh and I were too drunk to navigate on Google Maps, so we had to just we took safe haven inside of a McDonald's, ate quickly, and then tried to go find the station again, and we couldn't, so we gave up and had a cab take us on a $70 cab ride across Tokyo that lasted for a very long time.
Was it worth it?
I mean, we eventually got home, and then we went to sleep, or we got to the hostel and we went to sleep. But what was crazy, and I'm trying to, you know, spark notes this a little bit here, even though it's taken me 4 minutes to explain this, is that when I woke up that next day after this crazy drinking night, Josh had a horrible hangover and he didn't want to go outside. He just wanted to, you know, like, chill and get himself back. He was vomiting. He was just like, you know, super nauseous.
Which is the thing you were worried about.
Which was the thing that I was worried about that happening to me. I was not worried about it happening to Josh.
Are you proud of me? I listened to the episode. I'm all up to date on my WTDG lore.
Yes, it's so important. I never, I mean, this was my sickest that I got in Japan was after that night. I was surprisingly good after a more robust drinking night that would later on happen in Shinjuku, but that's a story for another podcast, or a podcast for another day.
Why?
What?
Why is it a story for another day?
Because I haven't even gotten to my
just tell it right now.
Okay, I'm getting to the Shibuya thing. So Josh said he didn't want to go out. I had the Wi-Fi dongle. He didn't. I tell him, you know what? Like, I'm feeling gross, but I'm gonna go. So I tell him, like, I'm gonna go, you know, hit some arcades. So I decided
to
walk.
Wi-Fi dongle.
What?
What do you mean Wi-Fi dongle?
The poo-poo-poo-poo-roo, I think, is the, it's like a Wi-Fi dongle that you can charge so that you never have to use your roaming.
All right.
Like a wireless hotspot.
Okay.
So I took that and went out alone, and I decided to walk from my hostel in Ueno to Akihabara, which was a bad idea. It was a very bad idea, because I think I may have, in fact, permanently damaged my feet doing so. And they hurt to this very moment of this very day, which is like almost 2 weeks later or something.
From taking a long walk?
After taking many long walks, then taking that long walk, and then for the rest of the week continuing to take long walks. Like, I was in so much pain that I would be limping because I had no bridge support in my shoes but I still kept limping on, and it was so painful. And by the end of the week, Josh and I were both in incredible pain, so we would have to, like, stop to, like, take a breather and get the pressure off of our feet because we were in so much insane pain.
I have a question. Yeah. While you were there, did you catch a Farfetch'd in Pokemon Go?
No.
Seems like a lost opportunity. I mean, if you're going to travel internationally, that might be the only time that I open up that app would be to catch the creatures that are, like, internationally dependent.
See, the crazy thing is that I'd have to play Pokemon Go, though. Yeah. That's where that falls apart for me. Pokemon, don't go to Japan and pull out your phone for Pokemon Go. Look around and experience the sights. And don't walk.
It's like those kids at the concert who hold up their phone and they're recording, and it's like, what are you doing? You're at the concert. It's right in front of you. The band is right there.
Pay attention. Just watch them. So I walked to Akihabara to go to arcades. And by the way, every common knowledge about Japan is almost wrong in every single case. But one case that it is most certainly wrong is that anyone who tells you that the best arcades are in Akihabara is just full of, they're full of curry. That's what I want to say. That's what, to keep it, you know, to keep it
curry?
PG, they're full of curry. They're full of chicken katsu curry is what they're full of. Because Akihabara does not have good arcades. And
I never heard that it did.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought that was I thought in large part it's like, oh yeah, you go to Akihabara for the arcades. If you had to say where you go in Japan, where do you go in Japan for arcades?
No, nowhere. I don't know. I don't have I don't look that stuff up.
Okay.
I haven't heard that anywhere in Japan has the best arcades. But it's not Akihabara is what you're telling me.
It's not Akihabara. It is most definitely not Akihabara.
Noted.
So I go to Akihabara, my feet, what do they say? My dogs are barking.
Yeah, that's definitely it.
Yeah. I think they actually do say that. So I take, that night. Okay. So I have not communicated. I left the hostel at this point approximately 4 hours ago at like 6 o'clock. No, wait a minute. Hold on. That's incorrect. No, that's correct. No, wait a minute. 3 hours ago. So then I take a 45-minute train, subway, Chigatetsu, over to Shibuya, and I have not, keep in mind that if you want the magic of this whole experience is like, look at my hands, there's no wires attached to my hands, and look at my Josh, I am not speaking to my Josh. Does someone from the audience come up and tell me that I have not spoken to my Josh? So I'm in Shibuya, I'm hungover. I'm increasingly, like, now I'm starting to feel it worse and worse. In the walk, like, over to Akihabara, I started getting, like, a little woozy every once in a while. So I'm in Shibuya just because I was like, you know what, let me do as much as I can up until the train stop at 12 o'clock. So I'm walking around a little bit, starting to not feel great. I go up to like the, you know, like 10th or 11th floor of this towery, like records, kind of Japanese Tower Records place where I'm looking at all their, I'm looking for Crying albums, could not find it. Thank you, Ryan Gowen Crying, for the Eastern Music. We find the, at the cover Bandcamp, they're on the new album. We use the intro Revive off, the new album Beyond the Fleeting Gales. It's not new. And I go back to the station at like 11:30, so I'm gonna miss the train. Like, I need to get on this next train. I'm walking around the station. The railroad, the trains are controlled by different companies. So imagine in New York, if like I the G train or the, like, I don't even know New York trains off the top of my head, but it's like the 1 and the G train are controlled by different companies, but they intersect. So you want to transfer onto 1. But you don't realize that, like, a fare won't cover both of them because you have to get off and then pay for a new ticket for a different line. Like, all the lines, there's
Japan
multiple
Transit
different...
sounds pretty lame. I mean, based on the two things you're telling me, which is, number one, that they stop at a certain hour, and number two, this bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, this was, I think, the worst thing about Japan. Like, one of the most obvious steps backwards that they have going to Japan from here is to see there not just be a regular, you know, Tokyo Metro should just control everything, but instead you got fucking JR Yamanote with his hands in the pot, like, mixing it up, and then you got all these other rustlers, the B line. What are they doing? Get them out of here. I buy a ticket back to for the Ginza line back to Ueno, and I walk over and the machine won't accept it because I bought the wrong company's ticket. So I'm confused, and like, this is like the, you know, the third day. I'm starting to get, like, more nervous, and my time is running out. I need to make the next train. I'm looking at the subway map. The subway map is like, some subway maps have English on them. The one I'm looking at has no English on it, and I'm just like, where is Ueno, and how much is it to get to Ueno, and which company controls the train that I need to get to Ueno? What is going on? And I'm getting so confused, and it was probably the closest, like, culture shock, like, truest culture shock I ever had, where I was looking around like, oh my god, it's only Japanese people and me, and they can't speak English, and every time I try and speak English to them, they seem confused, and they like, don't want to talk to me, unless I can speak to them well in Japanese, and this is too complex of an emotion for me to convey. So I'm walking around, going back to where I originally, like, trying to trace my steps to where I originally got off the Ginza line to get to Shibuya, and who is standing there but Josh, the smooth man, the smooth boy, Mac Attack. He had, without telling me, because he didn't have Wi-Fi, gone by himself to Shibuya after I just told him, like, I'm gonna go to arcades, probably gonna go to Akihabara, and we both were getting on, you know, we were both taking the exact same train. I mean, it's the last one, so it's a little bit less random, but in the same station in Shibuya, and taking the same route, because there would have been different ways to get back. It could have taken the JR Yamanote or the Ginza line. And I literally thought I thought that I was losing my mind. I really thought I had died, because I was getting so, like, overheated and stressed, and, like, the hangover was catching up to me, and I'm, like, feeling sick, and I need to get onto this last train, and I can't describe to anybody what's going on. Like, I can't ask them, like, in complicated enough words, like, how I need to, like, which trains I need to be on, and I can't understand. And was just getting so frustrated, and then Josh is there. It was so weird. He had not, like, the fact that, like, there is anywhere in Tokyo he could have been, and he decided the same, like, part of Tokyo he wanted to be in that one night without communicating, and then I went somewhere first and then went over there. To me, like, nothing, like, it just describing it cannot say how insanely weird it is that if, like, you visited, you know, like you can think of New York, and New York is much smaller than Tokyo, or, like, Manhattan. If you visited with a friend and you're like foreign to New York, and then both of you split up one day, like, and you're doing your own thing, and then in all of the places in New York, you both, like, without speaking, decide to go to the same place, and then you're there at the exact moment in this super insanely busy train station, how weird it would be to see that person, like, wow, you're getting on this train at the same time. We did not communicate. You could have been anywhere else in this wild city of Nihon, of Tokyo, and yet you're here with me, and I appreciate that.
All right,
does that adequately describe how, like I feel like it's the kind of thing where just hearing it you'd be like, yeah, whatever. Maybe you can't understand it unless you saw it, or maybe the more you think about it, the more it's like, yeah, that is really weird that in a massive city you both accidentally, without speaking, decided to go to the same place that you hadn't been to yet, on the same night, and you're both taking the same line back, and not only that, but you're in the train station at the exact same time. Like, if we've walked in at different times, at, like, remotely different times, with how crowded the train station is, we wouldn't have found each other, obviously. But to be standing there, like, with each other at the same time, have accidentally found each other in Tokyo like that, is pretty wild.
You did it.
It was the magic of Shibuya.
Was it magical? Did you have any fun?
I had tons of fun. I thought it was awesome. The last day, all I could think about is going back to Kyoto and Osaka, because I did ask a lot of Japanese people where they would recommend going, and everyone from Tokyo is just like, nah, listen to me, go to Kyoto. That's where that's like the hip place. Like, all the Tokyo people are like, nah, Tokyo sucks. The real cool stuff is at Kyoto. And that's how they sounded. And I was like, okay, I'll take your word for it.
Did you feel that way?
I loved it there. I loved it in Tokyo.
In Tokyo, but what about Kyoto?
I never went to Kyoto.
Dad.
I spent the entire, I think it was a very successful trip because I went to a lot of places. I went to Shibuya, Ueno, Asakusa, Akihabara, Shinjuku, Harajuku, Nakameguro. I'm just listing places like Tsukiji. Like we went to a lot of places and we had no plans to do anything. We still managed to do a lot and to like people watch a lot and to speak a lot about the, you know, what we noticed was going on, like culturally different and than the United States, and like that part of
your,
it was.
Give me your hot takes.
Let's see, the hottest takes. I mean, I think one of the first things that I would say is that when you play Persona 5, you might think, you know, man, Japanese people are really creative. Like, they have, you do anything in that game, there's a little jingle for it. When you, like, the way that you hear Japanese people
speak.
Why
would I think that?
Why would you think that? I don't know. They're really creative.
I don't think that American people are creative just because there's some good American stuff out there.
I mean, it's so different. It's so otherworldly. Like, you can't play Persona. Persona seems like this just wild experience, but so much of, like, weirdly, so much of anime conversations is actually how people talk and act. And music playing all over the place. Drugstores would have their own, like looping music, like, in like, a video game when you go in and it's, like, 30 seconds of, like, cheerful looping music. And like it would just loop over and over again. Like they wouldn't play radio stations, they would just loop the same 30-second clip over and over again. Like music would play when we got in elevators. When I took money out of the ATM, it had a jingle. Nakameguro was a whole part of the city that had music piped in. Like imagine, like, you know, a couple blocks of New York where there's like stereos on top of the power lines that are like actually playing like soothing like jazz music.
All right.
I thought it was weird to see like that all that stuff is like that. Like a lot of Persona is like, it seems like it would be very, it seems like it would be very a caricature of Japan, and you know, wackier and yeah, like a caricature. Like you're seeing like the bits of Japanese culture that are different, made to stand out. But that Persona 5 is so accurate to Persona 5 and like Fire Emblem are so accurate to what that stuff is like that it's weird. Like the way that people talk, interactions, the overall look and feel of things. Just every little thing having quirks to it.
I don't know. I get all my Japanese culture from Terrace House.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there you go.
And everyone is like in Terrace House.
I thought it was crazy. In Tokyo Mirage Sessions, one of the major parts of, like, you go to different areas of Japan in that, and one of the major parts that you go to is Shibuya, and they have it like nailed down to a T, to the point where where like the first dungeon happens in a mall that exists in Shibuya 109. So like Josh and I had to go, we were like blown away by seeing these golden stairs, and at the top of the golden stairs in the video game is a portal to like the, you know, the crazy performance dimension. And you could just go up there. And it was so weird. It was so weird to see it. And we were thinking, like, wait, is that, like, can you just walk up there? Like, I thought that was something in there. I don't know. It was just...
So, here's a weird question. Were there a lot of homeless people?
I think I saw two of them. I also saw zero potholes, by the way. Zero potholes. I don't know. That is one of the most damning things that I bring back, information I bring back, is that our infrastructure is somehow worse than you may have imagined.
In New York, I don't see potholes a lot, but I also don't drive a lot, so it's hard to say.
In Long Island is a pothole.
It definitely is.
Yeah. So, other hot
does that take. Make you does that make you want to finish Persona 5?
It did. I came back with a real vengeance for that, but then, you know, I think I still have it on the brain. I still want to finish Tokyo Mirage and Persona 5. But it's hard when there's new stuff, you know? Like
Persona 5 is amazing though.
It's hard when you get sidetracked though. But I mean, yeah, it's amazing, but then I heard from you like, yeah, finish it. It's good, but the ending, they didn't really handle it that well. And when you hear that kind of,
I didn't say they didn't handle that ending well.
Okay.
No, that's a good ending. It's bittersweet.
Okay. I think one of the things that I was the most impressed by is the quantity of food for the price and the quality. You would expect to pay around $450 to $600 for a lot of meals, which translates almost like perfectly to $4.50 or to $6. And in Long Island and New York, in a lot of cases, when you go into a restaurant or even a deli, you have an innate knowledge that whatever you're gonna get is probably between $10 to $15 in a lot of cases, like $15 on the slightly higher end side, or maybe just overpriced. But in a lot of cases, like, you expect to pay $10 for a sandwich. And in Japan, most things were $4 or so to $6, and you got less. You got less of the food, but I think that the trade off was amazing. That if you think about going to a sit-down place here, and you're paying $12 to $15 or something in New York for a big plate of food, then you're paying, and instead of that, you're paying $4 for a tastier but smaller plate that's like a little over half the size. Then you finish it, and you walk away, and you're comfortable. But I always find myself in America, you pay that $10, and then you get this amount of food that is just a little bit too much. It's always a little bit too much. It's not enough in a lot of cases that you can save the food, but it's usually enough that you eat a lot of it and you think, well, I'm not gonna have only a quarter of my ramen. I'm not gonna have the last quarter of this sandwich come back home with me. That's a ridiculous thing. So you eat it. And you feel gross after it, because there's a whole different metric for how much food.
I feel like that really varies place to place.
It does, but I'm using it in generality. In general.
Yeah.
In general, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, yeah. But in terms of the money, are you sure it's not just because, like, maybe the American dollar does well there? Like, is there a more pointed like way that you could say like a meal is $4.50? Not because of the exchange rate, but just because food is cheaper. Like,
I don't know. I think that the two are very equal at the moment. They convert very cleanly, and to see a lot of the prices on. I mean, I think that one of the big things that I don't know is what is a salary like there? What is what is a night of overtime? How much does that get you? That's the big thing. It's like, I'm thinking about everything in terms of, I am thinking about everything in terms of conversion. So if I'm converting $5 American to 500 yen, and then I buy a whole meal with that, then I have to say that that's low. But I don't know if what the equivalent is in Japan.
Yeah,
I don't know how
time
much
worked.
What?
Like that's time worked is a good, nice, I guess, cross-cultural way to figure out money, right? Like, how much does the average person make in an hour?
Yeah. Yeah, what's a salary like?
Yeah, exactly.
What's your paper like? Regardless, though, it's not so important, just because the way that I'm looking at it is that the takeaway is that less food, less price, You kind of, you can eat and then you can go out and walk. And when I go to New York, in a lot of cases, if I'm eating and then walking around after that, you eat and then you feel sick when you're walking. You ate too much. You eat, even if it's a little bit too much, you just feel kind of happy to be walking because you kind of want to walk off some of that big burger you ate, that, and those 20,000 fries. But in Japan, it just felt like it was always a closer approximation to a human stomach rather than the restaurant trying to impress you with how much food they had, that you pay that $10 and then they want to, you know, shock you with the amount of fries that they're about to throw at you. It really felt like you pay for the amount of food to keep living rather than the amount of food to get sick. Rather than to be, like, embarrassed by the amount of food. To be a dragon that hoards food. And I think that was cool to see. I think that's a big difference.
I'd say so, yeah. It almost makes me a little sad knowing that maybe my portions are always just a little bit off. Because I understand what you're saying.
That was the saddest thing. That was the saddest thing for me. Was to see...
Although in Brooklyn, yeah, it can be a little bit different. Brooklyn and some more, you know, bougier places have a tendency to offer smaller plates of food.
Yeah, but for worse prices. A lot of times in America, the smaller the plates, the higher the price. I believe that. You are welcome to argue with me, but and especially when you look at tapas places, that if they're not doing like a flight or anything, like you're looking at the individual parts of the meal, you're expected to pay $8 to $10 for a small plate that is being eaten by a group of people.
You know, in Spain, where the tapas originated, tapas are free.
Well, then what are we doing wrong, James?
Tapas restaurants, you pay for the wine. And as long as you keep drinking wine, the tapas are free.
I would do well there. So would Chance the Rapper.
Chance would too, yeah.
That really was one of the biggest takeaways that was very upsetting, is that I am by force being fatter. I'm an EMT. I could make my own food, but go to hell. I don't want to do that because the only thing that gets me through 13 to 15 hours of work is that I can get, you know, a nice hot meal somewhere, not a cold apple from my lunchbox, you moron. So
I feel the same way. Yeah, lunch is one of my, like, I like lunch.
It's so important.
I like having a hot meal in the middle of the day.
It's so important to me. It's what gets me through. If I'm working and I'm exhausted and I'm hungry, then the thing that's getting me through is, where is this next, when I take this person to this hospital, what are the local food places? What might I be able to eat tonight? And stuff like that. So I want to eat something good, but you're being forced into eating more food just because that's what we expect. Is we expect to pay $10 and over, and then to get an approximate amount of food, which I'm eating, and I'm eating, you know, casually, like I'm a $6-7 worth of that $10 of food. So then you have $2-3 of just extra food that is not enough for me to really take home, or, you know, need to lug around all day, or to be worried about, is it being out too long? Is this enough food? This isn't even enough for a meal, so this is a side at this point in my next meal. It's ridiculous. So you end up just eating it, and you are fatter for it.
It's tough throwing it away.
You could throw it away, but it's tough throwing it away. You're fatter for it. The fact that we don't have the portions are so ridiculous, because you want something. You are in large part at most places just, you want one thing, and there is a portion of it. It's like a dinner portion, and it's just a little bit too much for a normal person. It's just
everyone loses on this deal.
Everyone loses. This ratio of food to amount is so important for so many reasons. I think it was also important because they were able to get the food quicker. The food was able to be fresher because they didn't have to just have a million pounds of meat in a refrigerator somewhere, because every time some American walks through the door, they need to cook up $15 worth of burgers And at some point, that means that a lot of it needs to be frozen because they have to have so much quantity of it because everyone is eating so much food.
You know what's disappointing in lieu of this conversation? I actually feel like I had a bad lunch today.
It's disappointing. It breaks your whole day down.
I might have a spot of food poisoning like coming on. And you know that feeling in your stomach where you know things aren't going right in there, but there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to wait.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's where I'm at right now.
And all the food was better. I know it's such a cheap thing to say. I know it's such a cheap thing to say, but I feel like
you're having a good time, so I feel like that makes the food taste better.
What?
You're having a good time there, so it probably makes the food taste better.
Yeah, it just felt more, you know, more attention to detail, more seasoned. Whereas in America, it just feels like they're really, like, we have people who make fun of seasoning meat and are just say, you know, we have this dumbass culture that a lot of times it literally just comes down to why would you put dry rub on that steak? What's wrong with you? This is the right way to do it, okay?
I'm going to be honest with you, Ryan.
What?
I totally reject the idea that food is better in another country.
It is.
I reject it. I refuse to believe it.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but it is.
Because people who are really good at their trade move that trade around. Like, people who have a really good restaurant are going to have, like, inevitably, it ends up in New York. Like, people will bring their food over to New York.
I mean, I didn't go to big restaurants. I mostly just went to just a sushi place where there's one guy working, just one guy behind the counter, and you yell at him your sushi order and he goes, he just does it.
So do you mean to say that the general food, like not like the top of the top, but just like what you find walking down the street, your average food is better than the average food?
Yeah. I didn't have any. I never went to any upscale, super ritzy places, but
I feel like I'd have to. I feel like I'd want to see like the best that they have to offer.
I mean, we just went to the regular places, just the run of the mill. You're walking down the street and you go into a small place that's not a chain or anything, just owned by someone somewhere. Get some sushi, go out, leave. You know?
I don't know.
Well, I'm telling you.
I haven't done that.
I'm telling you.
So where do you want to travel next? Because, like, I'll tell you that Japan is on top of my list. Like, that's
Kyoto and Osaka, I just said. I'm going to Kyoto and Osaka next year.
Wait, so the next place in the world you want to travel is Japan?
Oh, yeah, that's most definitely.
Number two. Number one is Japan. Number two is Japan.
Number one. Most definitely. Next year, Kyoto and Osaka. This year was Tokyo. Next year, Kyoto and Osaka. The year after that, Hokkaido.
I don't know. There's a lot of world out there. I'd want to get some more different varied places.
I don't know. I was so happy with this part of the world that I just felt like I need to understand. I need to see more of this part of the world.
Why don't you just move there?
I wish. I would. If someone had, especially on the last day, if someone had just come up to me and said, hey, work at a menial job for me. I'll pay, like, it'll pay the rent. You'll live here. I would have said, yep. But
Indeed.com would have said that to you.
What?
Indeed.com would have said that to you.
Maybe. To work most jobs in Japan, though, you need a certain you need to pass a literacy test that I could not pass at the moment.
Ah.
I would have to get an off-the-books kind of job, I would think.
As like a doughboy.
Yeah, just some sort of doughboy. I mean, I could be, I could go into hard drug dealing, I guess. That's not something I do in America, but I imagine it would pay the bills very well.
That's just a doughboy.
Doughboy. Yeah,
they call those doughboys.
Yeah, just doughboys. Yeah, it was awesome. I want to go right back. I want to go back to Kyoto and Osaka because they're very different flavors of Japan. I mean, all the different parts of the different districts of Tokyo are so different than each other that they just felt like different worlds in and of themselves. In the way that it feels like if New York, Boston, Seattle, L.A., San Francisco are all, you know, Dallas are all clumped next to each other and you're taking a train to the different ones and you're saying, wow, this one is so weird and different. The shape of the buildings, the general things that they're selling, the styles of clothes people, like, everything just felt a little bit different. The layouts of things.
I feel like you get that in New York though too, with different boroughs and districts. Like,
yeah, you get that totally primarily with like Chinatown.
That's not true at all. Like, Astoria is totally different from like Bushwick. The Bronx is totally different. And then there's like different areas in the Bronx. Like, there's Italian areas, Polish areas that are like way different than other parts of it.
Yeah, but those Italian areas have like big inflatable cannoli lanterns. Answer the question.
All right.
That's what I'm saying. Like, they're not flying that. You could go into an Italian place and you see more Italian, you know, you see Italian restaurants and pizzerias and bakeries, but.
And churches, like, and like stuff like that. Like, do you see different architecture?
But you don't see giant cannoli lanterns the way you might if there was an Italian district in Tokyo. There would be.
So what are you saying, that you saw a giant sushi lantern? Like,
oh, I did. They definitely love food. They definitely love.
I'm kind of pissed off that on your Instagram you took pictures of food on a plate.
I know, but not that much really when you look at it.
Yeah, but you didn't take one picture of an empty plate.
I thought that would be in poor taste. That is the one thing. That is another thing. I do think that that's something that Americans know about the Japanese. That there is a right way to eat food, and if you are not eating something the right way, they will correct you. It's so funny because. Overall, I found the Japanese people to be so kind and welcoming and helpful when I needed help, and so they would go so far out of their way to help. But the one thing that you can rub someone the wrong way very quickly is if you're eating sushi slightly wrong, then they will come over and like tell you to stop doing that. They will like manually correct you.
What do you mean by that?
I got sushi at this one place, and I usually, so in America we have maki mostly. We eat maki, which is like the rolled sushi that has, you know, lots of stuff in it, and they roll it up, and then they have the seaweed wrap on the outside, and then the, you know, the rice on the inside, which is the sushi, by the way. Sushi just means pickled rice, not fish. In Japan, mostly people eat nigiri, which is basically the sashimi on a bed of rice. So in large part, whenever you're eating sushi, you're just eating nigiri. So you're just eating a strip of raw seafood over a bed of rice. And in America, what I do is I pour a big thing of soy sauce, and I really dip that in the same way that wings are a vehicle for blue cheese. Sushi is a vehicle for soy sauce. I get a lot of that soy sauce on there. I like to get that soy sauce on there. Like to dip it on both sides and then eat it. That's not really that possible with nigiri, because if you use chopsticks for nigiri, it can be kind of difficult, and the bottom, the bed, will break apart pretty easily. But especially the second it touches, if you put it in a big wet bowl of soy sauce, the whole thing will start dissolving, and you'll start having to like pick at it unless you do it like super fast, and you have to have a very thin layer of soy sauce. And if you have more than a thin layer, then the bottom layer soaks up, then breaks apart really quickly the second you put it in. So I was eating nigiri, generally there's only like two people who work in most of the places in Japan. It was very weird to see. Most things are really run by. If something could be run by one person, they generally were. But this place had two people, someone bussing and someone making the sushi. And I was eating the nigiri, and it broke apart. So I'm like fishing the bit of tuna out of the bowl, and, you know, picking at the larger parts of rice. And then a waitress, like, actually laughing, comes over and is like, I forgot what she said. She was like, too much, too much.
Was the laugh like Karen? Like, oh!
It was like an Ojo-sama laugh. It was seriously like, oh, too much, too much. And then she put down a paper, this little pamphlet made for, I guess, English, because this was in a more touristy part. This was in Gaijin. What?
You Gaijins.
Yeah, it was a pamphlet that said in English, like, the correct way to eat nigiri. Don't put too much soy sauce. Don't dip it like that. Don't do this. Like, she laughed at me and then gave me a pamphlet that said, you're doing it wrong. It was actually one of the most embarrassing moments. It was, weirdly enough, one of the most embarrassing. Like, I turned beet red. Josh, the chef was, like, looking at me, saying, like, yeah, you were eating it wrong. And I was looking at you, and I'm glad she came over and corrected you. That this he portrayed with his eyes. And then Josh did a hands-up kind of I'm not with him motion, and she's still laughing at me, and I'm just looking down at my plate thinking, what have I done? This is the worst. This is the worst experience. I wanted to pay for sushi. I shouldn't be getting laughed at. I'm paying you people money. That happened.
Do you think
it was
you deserved
worst.
It?
What do you say?
Did you deserve it?
I don't know. I don't think so.
You might have, though.
I didn't think I looked like a total slob. I mean, I shouldn't have had that much soy sauce in the bowl, yeah. That's what I do for maki.
Too much.
I didn't have that much time to experiment. It was like my second bowl. It was my second plate of sushi that night. So, like, calm down. I've only eaten...
Dude, I just got two. So, as you know, I've been I'm playing this golem build in Path of Exile.
Are you playing it now? Literally now?
I am, and I'll tell you why. It's because I just walk around. It doesn't actually require thought.
Oh, my God.
But I did get two... So I'm farming at Ziri right now, and I got her rarest drop twice in a row.
Wow.
68 chaos apiece.
I found an Exalted Orb, which was one of the craziest fucking things that has happened to me in that game.
Which is kind of disappointing that, like, the thing that is the most exciting to see drop... is that
that is a huge complaint I have of that game. In Diablo, everything is a lot more self-found, and in Path it is cool that the gear is so often, more often than not, 99.9% of the time rolls like shit, so the really good gear is really hard to find, and it makes it really worth it. So you might never see any good gear ever drop for you, but the time that you do, it might make your entire account rich. But you never, it sucks because I'm playing a build, and I don't think I've ever had the experience of finding something that was really going to work for my build, or I haven't found anything yet that was so rare and interesting that instead of selling it, I wanted to build around it, you know?
I do know. And one of the reasons is that, like, because of the way that the game works, because what are the chances that you as a singular person is going to find something, like, compared to the other guy? Like, compared to the other 100,000 guys who are looking.
Yeah, but in 100 hours?
You just list it.
In 100 hours, I should find something of significance. I suppose I shouldn't be complaining because I literally just got an Exalted Orb, and they're worth good money right now. They're worth 80 chaos, but...
And those 100 hours are not doing the content that drops the best stuff.
Fair enough.
And most of the really, really good stuff comes from, like, extreme end game. Like, where, let's say you're fighting the Shaper because you want Starforge, and the only way to get Starforge is off of Shaper. And it's like, when the Starforge drops, it's awesome. But at the same time, it's like, you're goddamn right the Starforge drops. That's why I'm here. It's similar, I guess, in a way to Destiny or to World of Warcraft, where you're chasing that one unique item that drops off a very particular enemy. And it is kind of the same way in Path of Exile, where it's like, if you want Zoth's blood, then you're going to Breaches. If you want Ziri's Acuity, then you're going to Uber at Ziri. If you want Starforge, you're going to Shaper, things like that, where, like, the really, really build defining items are coming off of these super duper late game bosses.
Yeah, I mean, fair but unfair. Firstly, because for Destiny there's a much lower time to get into late game stuff, and then secondly, Destiny and WoW have a built-in conceit that the rareness of an item isn't really that important because there's no overall auction, there's no overall economy for it. And in Path of Exile, if your build is turned on by Starforge, you likely won't get Starforge yourself. You likely will have to buy it because your build, because like good amazing builds and hyper end game is doing Shaper and all that other stuff. So you're never throughout the time, like when you're playing Destiny, everything is self-found. Everything you find for yourself, and it's exciting to use. And in Path of Exile, nothing I find. Like, a good find is a good find because I can sell it and then get a better find for myself. But I've never gotten anything that felt like I've been putting in the hours and finally I got this thing and I'm so excited about it that I'm going to build around it, or I'm so excited because it's making my build good. You know, like I had heard you talk about a long time ago. I remember something to the effect of that you'd be playing. And this was probably before you were as knowledgeable, as regimented as you are right now. But you used to talk about playing, and you'd play for a while, and then suddenly something would drop, and it would be build defining. But that never happens. That's such a lie that would ever happen, because nothing you ever find is build defining. You only ever find good, like, whenever I find anything good, it's only because it's sellable.
Be honest, there's plenty of build defining things. They just don't, they're not all worth a lot of money. Like, there are some build defining uniques, like, that cost a few chaos. Clay Shaper, for example, is build defining if you want to play with golems. They just don't cost anything. They're not that rare. On the other hand, they have created like an entire playstyle around what your complaint is, and it's called solo self-found.
Yeah.
Where everything that you find is you can't trade, essentially.
Uh-huh.
So they do have that.
Is that a meaningful playstyle, or is that like a self-imposed rule?
No, it's a meaningful playstyle. When you choose a league for your character, you choose softcore, hardcore, solo self-found softcore, or solo self-found hardcore.
Oh, wow. So the hardest shit in the game would be solo self-found hardcore.
Yeah, and there are some people, some streamers, who are totally based around solo self-found and hardcore.
Still love the hell out of it. I was going to ask you, because I was kind of thinking about it, what is your opinion of, you know, now... I got
Guild Wars 2, Path of Fire.
No.
Okay, go on.
I was gonna say, what is your opinion? Like, could you have guessed during Fall of Oriath that you would have friends playing, that I would have 100 hours in, and that Austin, my partner from work, would literally do nothing but play Path of Exile?
No, I always assumed that Path of Exile would only be a game that I ever played, and I'm being totally honest. I never thought anybody but me would play it.
Is it exciting for you, or is it, you know,
yeah,
whatever? Like, you're still going to, I know you're still going to play it anyway, but.
No, it's awesome. It's really good to have other people to talk about this game with. It makes me feel a little less crazy that there's more people on board. And also, like, your playtime feels like more meaningful when you have like friends who are playing it.
Yeah.
I mean, someone is actually like, oh shit, you got an Exalted Orb. Like, if I were there when that dropped, I would have been like, you stole my Exalted Orb. Are you sure it didn't drop for me and you just picked it up?
Oh man, that would have been nasty if that's the kind of thing. That's why you really need that permanent allocation loot, because that's the kind of thing that if that drops and someone doesn't get to it in time, or you see it after the fact, you're walking around like, oh shit, there was an Exalted Arbor on the floor. Like, who is that? How do we not hate each other after this?
Yeah, especially since my character has like pretty slow move speed. I probably wouldn't notice it, and then that would be it.
Hmm. Pizza Sticks came online for me. I'm enjoying that a decent amount. I still need to get my last Ascension. I think it'll make a huge deal. It'll make a massive deal for my Raider and for my Pizza Sticks, my Tornado Raider, and my Pizza Sticks character. The Pizza Sticks thing feels, at the moment, a little bit stronger at level 70 than my Raider feels at level 80, just because it's a little bit more tanky. It does better against bosses, and it's slower but more consistent. Whereas
so when you Ranger... when you play as bosses, are you switching your gems around for pizza sticks?
I know that there is changes, but I have a good medium of like my stuff should be generally pretty good for both. I don't have six slot anymore, so. Yeah.
Because typically what people do is they'll take out area of effect and they'll change it to concentrated effect just for boss fights.
Yeah, that is something that I should be doing a little bit more. But it's hard because some of those bosses are fast. They jump out of that.
Yeah, but most bosses have boss rooms, so you know they're coming up.
Yeah. No, I mean that their bosses are fast. Like they'll jump out of the AoE.
True. Yeah, you got to have a decoy totem or something like that.
I don't understand how the number of totems works.
I think there's a global number, so it's like if you have X number of spell totems, then you can't put down a decoy totem.
Yeah, so I can't put down decoy totems because that would cut down on my damage way too much.
Yeah, what are you up that to? Two totems or three at this point?
Two.
Two.
How would I get three other than Tukahama's Revenge or whatever?
Yeah, that's a good item.
Yeah,
it's
I know.
It's a very hard item to use because the item gives you blood magic, which means that casting spells comes out of your health pool.
Uh-huh.
So it can be scary.
I mean, you don't have to cast that many spells with this because you're in large part, the totems themselves, the spell totems don't cost that much. So you're just dropping that down.
Do you have auras?
Right now, no. I was using anger for a little while.
Yeah, then it would be fine because blood magic would also make it so that your reserved mana would be taken out of your health pool as well.
Mm-hmm.
That can get harsh.
Wow. Wow, that really works like that?
Yeah.
That's effed up.
Painful stuff. Did I move into video games too soon? I'm sorry.
No, we can do this. Because
I know we have to skirt around video game conversation sometimes.
No, I mean, I mean we're an hour in. I think we're there.
People really come to this podcast for the slice of life stuff. They don't really care about the video game discussion.
Yeah,
I found that's what our testing shows.
I bought Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite and have played.
I thought about that.
I have played about 3 hours of it.
That's not a lot. That's very little.
It feels like 10 hours.
Does it feel like something you've played before?
In a way, yeah.
So tell me about that game. You know, I was interested in it when they said that the Monster Hunter would be a character. And then when I found out that the Monster Hunter was
going to be DLC. Oh, you mean when it leaked? When it leaked months ago that it would be a character and not when Capcom said it. Because they still haven't said it.
Yeah, so when I saw that was going to be a character, I got kind of excited. And then I found out that they're not a character. Not yet. They're going to be DLC. So I opted out.
Good for you.
I'll wait for Super. I'll wait for Ultimate.
Oh, God.
Does that sound like a good idea? How are you liking the game? What's your favorite Infinity Stone?
Oh, my God.
Do you like the Power Stone? Do you like just having Hagar say, Power Stone, Power Stone, to remind you of a better Capcom game?
Oh, my God. That game is so frustrating to talk about.
Why is that?
It's making me frustrated. It's making me sick just talking about it. It is so interesting, and it could be so good given time, but it is so marred every which way you look. People have been giving it shit for, I think the first thing I want to say is that people have been giving it shit for how it looks for a really long time. The game is uglier in person. I don't know how that's true. It is one of the most challenging things I've ever had to look at with my eyes. This is so frustrating. That in itself, I know I can be like you know full well that I can be very like aesthetics come first. If the aesthetics aren't good, then in a lot of cases I don't want to see the next thing. Like that is the first gate to figuring out if I'm gonna like something. Fighting games are typically smaller downloads. This is not at 55 gigs. I don't know what the 55 gigs is for, but fighting games, there's not a lot of assets in fighting games. You can make them look really good. You're supposed to make them look really good. They don't. Capcom seems to struggle.
Super Mario Odyssey is like 6 gigs.
Yeah, like, what is It's unbelievable that there's that many gigs and the game looks, the game is that large of a download and it looks this ugly. I don't understand it. The characters themselves were taken in large part, most of the characters, with very few exceptions, come directly from Marvel's Capcom 3, and they've somehow made them uglier. I don't know why they did that. I don't get it at all. They took the same moves. They used the same animations. That was fine. But then they decided to remodel the character uglier. All of them. They remodeled them uglier. I don't know why they did that. I don't get it. Why is the game so big? It's so ugly. I don't get it.
Big, ugly game, huh?
Why is it so ugly? It looks awful. It looks awful. It is... When fighting games should be... One of the most important things about fighting games are the aesthetics. You're watching something happen again and again and again. If an animation looks bad, then you're not watching it, you know, once or twice. You're watching it constantly, replaying constantly. If a projectile or particle effects look bad, you're watching that constantly. This game looks like shit, and you keep rewatching it. You keep having to watch it. It is so hard to watch. It is so ugly. Like, there is so many dynamic... Under the ugly, horrible, disgusting veneer is, in some parts, a very complicated... One of the most complicated and expressive games that I've ever seen in fighting games. The whole concept of the tag thing is so insane. For people who don't know, you can press a button to tag out at any point... But you can do that while your characters are doing things. So instead of in old Marvel games, you'd have an assist button that would do a canned animation for, like, call in Ryu to do Hadouken. But in this game, you do the Hadouken, and then you call your character out. You switch characters, and Ryu is still doing the Hadouken. So you get all this different things of, like, the game would be so... creative at a high level where not only would you be able to do these complicated combos, but you'd be able to do weird setups, stuff where a character, Chun-Li, is doing lightning legs, and then you switch in a different character, and then you jump over the side and cross them up and attack a different way. Like, you could do all that stuff. You could be very creative.
So I've also heard that, like, every character has an infinite combo, or, like, a lot of characters have an infinite combo. I don't know if you know anything about that. Do you think that might be the case?
I hadn't really heard that characters had infinites. I don't know that much about that, but I can imagine that. I could imagine the balance being effed up right now, but I think right now I'm seeing a lot of videos for, like, a lot of damage for characters, but no touch of death for characters. Yeah.
Also, like, you know, on an aside, I briefly mentioned they announced the size of Super Mario Odyssey. I wish that I somehow had a way to remove everything I know about that game from my mind.
Why?
Because everything about that game looks so damn good. And, like, previews just came out today. And it looks like it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, probably will be.
I feel like I know too much.
Maybe,
like,
it's gonna
I'd rather go in knowing nothing.
What if it's the Breath of the Wild of Mario?
I think it will be. Like, I think that this will probably be the best Mario game.
Wild. Breath of the Wild.
I don't know if it'll have the staying power that, like, Super Mario 64 does, but, you know, I'm hopeful, dude. It looks really exciting.
It does look good.
But Marvel doesn't.
I mean, it doesn't. It literally doesn't look good. It is so ugly. Why did they make such an ugly game? Why? I don't get it. It had to have at some point been deliberate. I cannot believe that developers would make such an ugly game, and they used assets from the other game that had better graphics. Why? I don't get it. I don't understand it.
And you know, the game has seemed like sort of like people have known this for a while, and I assume that means Capcom has had they've known how people feel. But I don't know that they're trying that hard with this, to be honest.
I mean, they fixed Chun-Li's face, which was the ugliest face, the ugliest of the ugliest faces in this ugly, ugly, ugly game. But they still aren't there yet. And so much, everything The problem with looking at the game is that everything needs to change. Everything needs to change. At some point, one little patch can't do it. You have a 55 gig game. Why is it so big and so ugly? A lot of things need to change in this game before the game starts actually looking physically good. What they probably will do is, because the game is so damn ugly, is that they'll probably put those, you know, comic book lines on the characters when they re-release it as Marvel Infinite 2 or, you know, Super Marvel Infinite, Ultimate Marvel Infinite. It is so ugly. It's frustrating because when I'm not playing the game, I have this interest in it to jump in, to learn more of the characters, to start working on finding the characters.
Who do you like so far?
Nobody.
Nobody. All right. I would probably play Firebrand and Arthur.
Jedha is kind of cool. Gamora is kind of cool. I mean, it's so it's really frustrating to come into the game and have played so much Marvel 3. So characters don't really have... I don't have that spark. I don't have that spark with characters where I don't see Dante and then say, oh yeah, I can't wait to learn Dante, because it's like, yeah, you have to relearn Dante. It's the weird thing is that they changed enough that you can't play. They changed enough of the systems and the mechanics and some of the more complicated stuff, like OTGs aren't really there anymore. And now it's more about there's like actual OTGs built into combos and stuff like that. So they changed a lot of the little things. So you can't go to Dante, especially, who is a character that I played a lot and probably would have the muscle memory for. There used to be a stinger cancel. You used to do a like a light, medium, heavy, forward, heavy cancel button. Do his like it was called a brave cancel, and then cancel the brave cancel with the ground pound kicks and like do all this this combo stuff. But they changed all that. But he's still essentially the same character. So you're trying to. It's this weird media. It's this weird in between where you know them enough that you're not excited for them, but they're familiar enough that you feel frustrated having to relearn them. And then the characters that are new are ostensibly Thanos, Captain Marvel, Gamora, Jedha.
Captain Marvel, is that like a? What's that like? That's not Miss Marvel, right?
It's Miss Marvel. It's the blonde female with an ugly face, because all of them have ugly faces. So Captain, that's the only characters. Oh, Ultron, Thanos, Captain Marvel, Jedha. Basically it. Gamora. That's very few. And the new ones are mostly on the Marvel side, because. As you know, the other big controversy is that there's no X-Men, and X-Men have always played a huge part in this series. It started out as Children of Atom. That was like the first time Capcom did a fighting game with the Marvel franchise. That was a X-Men fighting game, and the characters that have, you know, really been mainstays, you know, Magneto, Storm, Sentinel, like, these are huge characters for that franchise, and none of them are in it.
Especially Sentinel.
Yeah.
Huge.
He literally huge. And
big guy.
They, you know, that it's much publicized that they went to all the Marvel cinematic universe. Yeah, the MCU stuff. And there's enough to draw on there. They added Thanos, Ultron, and Gamora. So there's something going on, but to have them be as lazy as they were with the Capcom side, and I feel like they're even still lazy with the Marvel side to you know, only have those new characters. I don't think that Ultron is that different. It's so frustrating to look at it and play it. There's so much creativity that if I didn't think the game was so atrociously ugly, and if the game wasn't being currently developed by a company that can literally only develop Monster Hunter and nothing else, because they're just rapidly losing their fan base for fighting games. Like, they just have no goodwill going into this game. There's no goodwill. The trust that I have that Capcom will do a good job with this game is zilch. The most interesting characters that they have kind of announced are all DLC characters. You had to pay like an extra $30 or whatever bucks for DLC characters for to finally make this game unique. Like, yeah, maybe when we get Black Panther and Monster Hunter and stuff like that, the game will start feeling different enough and exciting enough. Maybe in 2 years, this game has a roster that puts itself realistically different. It feels different enough from old Marvel that you get excited about learning the characters. But right now, on launch, I just cannot get excited about learning these characters in this game. They're so boring. Why did they put the same characters in this game and they made them uglier? Why is it so ugly? Why is it so ugly? It's so ugly. It is so ugly.
At least they got that Monster Hunter coming.
It is so, so ugly.
They put a release date out for Monster Hunter Worlds, by the way. That's January 26th.
There is a lot of interest in that game right now.
That's not too far off either. That is not too far away.
There's a lot of interest in that game right now, I will tell you.
Especially with me.
I've been saying this, you know, this I know it's not happening in 2017, but in 2018, I think it might continue the year of the games that deserve to get their time in the spotlight, getting their time in the spotlight. And I think Monster Hunter could be the non-niche Monster Hunter, you know?
I think so. And I will say, though, that January 26th release date only confirmed for consoles.
Oh my god, why is it so ugly?
I will say, however, that I will buy Monster Hunter Worlds twice if I have to.
Oh, it's so ugly. It's weird because a lot of people talk about how ugly it is, and then some people are shocked that why does it constantly get mentioned how ugly Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite is? And I think the real answer is that they went for a realistic style and then failed. Like, if they went for, like, something like Street Fighter 4, I think that's an ugly-looking game. All the people are all buff meatheads that have muscles on top of muscles, and it looks weird. And I don't really like the color palette, and I think it's generally pretty ugly. But I managed to play it a lot because, you know, it was more, like, ugly and artistic choices. This game is, like, they went for the aping the more real the colors of the Marvel, you know, cinematic universe and that kind of, like, the CGI of Guardians or whatever, and they went for that, but then they did such a bad job on the faces, so it's this constant uncanny valley with all the faces and the animations that, like, it's not comic booky enough, and it's trying to be real, but they don't look good enough to be real, so it just looks like shit. I can't believe it. Fighting games are important. It's important how they look. And if you look at Guilty Gear in motion, you're blown away every single time. And it always looks badass. And the characters inspire you to want to play that game.
And, like, have you seen, like, Dragon Ball Z Fighters? Like, I feel like the primary thing that game has going for it is people look at it and they say, wow, this really looks like Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah, it looks killer good. And also, by the way, if you think that's the primary thing, maybe you haven't been following up on it, because holy shit, they are really buffing that roster up, and the characters that they're adding.
I know what you're saying, but, like, for the people who don't care about fighting games,
yeah,
they care that it looks like DBZ.
Yeah, it sure does. It really does. It really does look like DBZ in motion. And I mean, that's something that when that game comes out, there's a lot of lab time, it won't bother you in a lot of cases. It won't bother me, I know, because you'll be watching it and be saying, like, man, this character looks sick, and these animations look so dope, and this game looks...
I feel like, and I've got, like, my day planned out for that, by the way. Like, I know that, like, I'm going to be in the lab, and I'm going to have my screen, like cut between, all right, so on the left side, I'm in the lab, I'm practicing combos. On the right side, I'm going through Dragon Ball. I'm just gonna watch the series as I sit in the lab just practicing.
Yeah,
I look forward to that.
It's weird because, you know, you spend so much time in the lab, and this is a game where every second you're looking at it, you're like, why is that the animation? Why did they do that? Why is this character so goddamn butt ugly? Why did they do that? And I don't see characters or animations in this game or anything that inspires me to play them yet. Like, I'm not seeing anyone that is like, that is just so sick, the way that they move or the way that they look or animate, that I gotta put more time into it. I don't know. I was saying to you, Tekken took a little while for me to understand, and now I have like over 100 hours in Tekken. I really like Tekken, but I don't know.
Have you played more Tekken or more Path?
What?
Have you played more Tekken or more Path of Exile?
More Path.
That's crazy.
It is. Actually, I could look up the numbers right now. Do a live Path of Exile 117 hours.
That's wild.
Yeah, Path of Exile 117 hours. Oh, Tekken 212 hours.
That's unsurprising.
Okay. Marvel Infinite 3 hours, and they've been a rough 3 hours, let me tell you. Rough, unfortunately.
You're past the point where you can return it. Sorry.
Let me tell you, that thought was me the entire time. I have never played a game up until this point. Whenever I'm buying games on Steam, I usually buy them from devs that I like and trust, and I'll buy something and know maybe the first couple hours it's not really for me, but I already paid the money. It's not a big deal. I don't feel too upset with my decision to try it out. This is a
Did
game.
Did you buy like a season pass or something like that too, or what?
Yeah, it's bad.
Oh, no,
I know.
How much did you pay for that game?
I don't want to talk about it.
Was it $60?
No.
Because I'll tell you that for Divinity Original Sin, I paid $45. $45 for Divinity Original Sin 2.
Yeah, it's weird going to Japan and seeing that they don't have any set prices for video games. They all have their own price. It's weird. Why do we have like such a
Ask
set price?
Ask me about haggling.
Yeah. Before I really want to hear about Divinity. I just really want to in 10 seconds say I'm playing the Metroid Samus Returns on 3DS.
How's that?
It's really good.
Do you like having a portable game? Like, it's this thing to have a little game.
I think it's very, very good. I think it's the best, one of the best looking 3DS games I've ever played, if not the best 3DS game I've ever played. The animations are really unbelievable. The game is a more action-y oriented Metroid, but it still has all the Metroidvania style gameplay where you're fighting bosses and getting new power-ups and exploring a map and filling out spaces on a map and collecting collectibles and stuff. And it's very, very good, and it's very much what you'd expect if you like Metroidvania games. Then this game is waiting for you. But I do really want to hear a deep dive into Divinity, because I myself have been very excited about it. And to be honest, after having played Marvel a little bit, I'm very excited. I'm even more excited, because at first I thought I wouldn't have the time, and now I feel like I do have the time. Now I feel like maybe I need something to invest my time in that will take me away from this rotting carcass of Marvel.
Divinity Original Sin 2 is really good. The first problem that I had with Divinity, the first one, is the story was like all over the place. It's like you get in the first Divinity, you get brought into this town and it's like, okay, you have to solve this murder mystery. And then at some point you're like pulled into another dimension and they're like, hey, you're this magical being that's going to save the world. And at the same time, like, the writing was trying to be too funny. It was trying to be too serious. It felt like they didn't have a grasp on what they wanted to do. On the other hand, the mechanics of the game were really good and really interesting and very difficult, where you had all of these different interactions where if you're in a rainstorm and you use a lightning spell, then it's going to carry really far. If one of your characters emits a poison cloud on enemies, the poison cloud can be combusted. Things have a different amount of weight to them, and you have telekinesis. You could pick things up using telekinesis and drop them on enemies. There's all these cool systems, but ultimately I couldn't stick with it because I thought the story just didn't hold up.
I remember very famously, I've always thought of Divinity as a Dungeons and Dragons video game for the first time. Very much open-ended and stat-based about what you could do or stuff like that. And I remember you talking about how you brought this barrel filled with water over to like fight enemies that were fire enemies, and you brought it really far out from this town and like threw it down and created a water area where you could fight the enemies easier. And it was so weird that you were able to decide that this town very far away had this water barrel and that you would physically bring it all the way over to this thing.
And you know, the thing that's crazy and moving into Divinity Original Sin 2 is that it's not just a sandbox in terms of the combat, but really the way that the narrative unfolds is so crazy. Just like the things that they keep track of. Like when you think of like one of those like a Telltale game where you see like so-and-so will remember this, and it's like, well, that's kind of a weird way to put it. But in Divinity Original Sin, like every single action that you do, like there should be like bubbles popping up over every townsperson's head that essentially says like so-and-so will remember this, because you have like different reputation with every single person in town, and they're all dependent on like what like character you're playing. But I think one of the things that really sells it like immediately is the different origin stories for the characters. So you have the option to create your own character, or you have the option to choose like a predefined character. This is one of the only times where I will say like, I don't want to create a character, just give me one of the ones that you can provide. Because the characters that they provided with you have like these really interesting origin stories, and some of them are a little like tropey and lame, but some of them are like actually pretty fascinating. So for example, one of them is like the Red Prince, and he's like this lizard who makes a deal with the devil and then is like rejected by his people and like outcast. But then like, so he's this rejected outcast, but like sort of has demonic powers. Or this bard, and the bard is considered to be a host, where I don't know if you've ever seen the show Legion, but essentially she's like the main character from the show Legion, where she's inhabited by different spirits. And one of the spirits is like extremely powerful and frightening and makes her a liability to anyone around her. The origin story for the character I chose is like this slave elf who was branded by her master. And essentially because of the brand, she's forced into a servitude and has to do anything that he says. And so her quest is just, she needs to find the master and kill him. But it's not just that. It's the fact that every race is treated differently, has all these different statistics. Like people will treat lizards differently, and lizards have the ability to burrow. And because they can burrow, they can find like treasures that other races can't find. So if you're with the lizard, then you have access to different pathways that other characters don't. Elves have the ability to eat the flesh of anything that they find and then gain its memories. So if you're like dealt with a mystery and someone is dead nearby, you can consume their flesh and you can see their memories before death. Dark. So that you can see how they died and like get a better understanding of the situation. So all of the characters have things that are specific to them in conversations. Like the character who's my main character, Sibyl, who is that cannibalistic elf slave, she has a different perspective on things because she was a slave and because she's an outlaw. And as you do different quests, your character will gain all of these different tags. If you do things that are like criminal in nature, you'll get the outlaw tag. If you do things that are heroic in nature, you'll get the heroic tag. And when you have these tags, it lets you go into conversations and puzzles with like different options.
Okay.
So it's really cool. Like essentially role-playing your character in specific ways. The game will take notice of the way that you play and say, okay, the way that you're playing is like a hero, so we're going to give you the hero tag, and that will allow you to respond to different actions more courageously. And some of them are also like stat-based, where if you have a certain level of necromancer, maybe you can say this option, or if you have different levels of strength or wit or intelligence, you can persuade people in different ways that you otherwise couldn't. And it's not just that, but it seems like all of the characters in your party have different motives. So the lizard person wants to speak to this. So I'm traveling with the Red Prince, and my character is Sibyl. So the Red Prince ran into this character who's called the Dreamer, and he's like, oh, I need to talk to this guy because he will explain to me what my fate is. But Sabeel recognizes him as being a hand of the master. So you're immediately thrust in this situation of like, okay, Sabeel wants to kill this person and the Red Prince needs him. So how do we sort this out? And essentially, if someone in your party starts to disagree with you enough, they'll just leave.
Oh, wow.
So you, at points you need to make judgment calls of like, which character do I feel more affinity towards? Who do I believe in more? And if this person leaves, how is that going to affect my combat moving forward?
Wow.
So essentially, like, I don't know, because so far all I know is that I've run into the origin characters. Like, so I have all of the origin characters like as part of my party. My favorite one is actually this character named Thane, who is, he's a like sort of, he's this other race. He's called like an Eternal, essentially. Like, he's a god race that lives forever. So he like has a totally different perspective on things. And I found him in like a secret area, but like his perspective on things is like pretty interesting. I think he's a well-written character. I don't know if you can find other characters. I think that the original Divinity let you hire on mercenaries, which essentially allowed you to just roll a new character. Maybe that's something that you'll get access to later on.
Okay.
So far, I haven't finished the first act yet. I've been hanging out in the first town for a long time, and it made me realize like how many exits to the first town there are and how many possible ways that you can get through it. And it's pretty impressive. I definitely don't have a handle on all the systems yet and on all the crafting yet, but it is impressive.
Yeah, it looks pretty crazy, and people are really digging it.
And also, like, there's a game master mode to it where you can essentially, like, DM a game.
Oh, wow. I was talking about that, like, a year ago.
Originally, that's something that they had in Neverwinter Nights, which is a much older game. So that sounds cool. I don't know if that's something that I could get into. Obviously, like, it's something that you would need a group of people to get behind. Also, Divinity Original Sin 2 can be completed entirely in co-op. That's split screen co-op or over the internet co-op.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that's a good game.
So you can recommend it.
Find out more of it. I recommend that game.
Huh. I wish I could recommend Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite.
Do you?
No, I don't. I definitely don't.
Do you wish you could recommend it?
I do, of course. I really do. I wish that it had more heart and soul in it. I wish that it weren't such an ugly game. I wish it didn't look like such an obvious cash-in, kind of, and that it
does, right?
I mean, it's so ugly. Like, it doesn't look like a game that was made from the ground up with a lot of care. It seems like the kind of game that was just pushed out very fast, as in, we need to get out this MVC, this MCU-supportive game. And people are going to buy it because they love the Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever. But not, you know, there's nothing else. There's nothing in there that feels like there's a lot of love. Like, the music sucks. The visuals suck. The animations suck. Like, just because they figured out how to do good mechanics doesn't mean that the game should get a pass after that. Like, they keep trying to hang their hat on. We know it's kind of, you know, not fully there, but the mechanics are good. And that's why you should love it. And that's what people apologists say for it. That's what FJMPen and, you know, like all the people, Maximilian Dude and all the people who seem to be really liking it right now say for it. It's like, well, the game is so fun. I'm having so much fun. It's like, it looks so ugly and heartless, man. It looks even worse up close. I can't believe it looks as bad as it does.
Like, are they even allowed to say that they don't like it? I don't know. I don't mean to be like a conspiracy theorist, but
I think Maximilian could. I don't think Justin Wong can. I don't know if FChamp can either. I think maybe he can, but I feel like Maximilian is in a good spot to say it. I'm not like being conspiracy theorist about it. I feel like they do believe what they're saying. But to be fair, they've got, you know, hundreds of hours with the game before it came out. They learned the combos, started getting into the nitty-gritty of like what makes the game, the mechanics so complex. So maybe it is more fun for them. Maybe when you spend a lot of time and you develop the mind games and you know how to pilot your characters better, the game gets more exciting. But initially, you know, without having a real cool setups or a good team or a good Infinity Stone and a good, you know, concept behind what my game plan is. It's just that it's ugly and plays boringly. Like, it, maybe if I, it, that I'm going to keep putting in time, and maybe when I hit that 10-hour mark, things start clicking, and I feel like it's fast and frenetic, and I'm jumping between characters and learning how to do all this crazy stuff and do all these crazy mix-ups and combos. And then I feel like it's the kind of game where you could spend just millions of hours in the lab figuring out the perfect characters that work together and setups that are, like unblockables and stuff like that. And yet the game looks so ugly, sounds so bad, is animated so poorly, has so little heart that it's hard to devote that kind of time.
I have a so here's a random question. I know that you were in Japan for it, but did you catch the last Nintendo Direct?
No.
The last Nintendo Direct was kind of fire, dude. It was kind of awesome.
You talked about that horseshit made by Bravely
Default
people.
Octopath Traveler. That game looks so good. It's on the Switch. You can play it. There's a demo out now.
Sell it to me because I don't want to waste a single moment of my time with Bravely Default.
It's not Bravely Default. Essentially, it's a story-based game called Octopath Traveler, where at the start of the game, you choose one of eight characters. They are going to come from different places and play differently. The two that they showed are, they showed the fighter and they showed the dancer. And essentially, the fighter has the ability to challenge anybody to a fight. And the dancer has the ability to try to allure people. And essentially, you're going to be using these eight different abilities to try to solve challenges or to like try to figure out different puzzles. It's going to have like a similar JRPG style combat to Bravely Default. I will say that I never disliked the combat in Bravely Default. There were things to dislike about Bravely Default, and the combat wasn't one of them. So if the game can nail the story and nail the style, and I like the style a lot, they're going for like a pretty unique like sprite, like HD, like sprite based look to it. I think the game looks really sharp, and it's a Switch exclusive, and there's nothing wrong with that. We could use more Switch exclusives.
Sounds like trash. What else happened?
They announced Doom and Wolfenstein for the Switch.
Okay. I mean, Doom's really good. I wonder how it looks.
I don't know if you heard this, but Square Enix is trying to get Final Fantasy 15 to run on the Switch.
Yes.
Also today, Tencent announced that their most popular MOBA will be coming to Switch. Not League of Legends, some other one that's extremely popular in China.
Do you know the name?
Arena of Valor.
Okay, that's interesting. That's worth checking out.
That will be coming to the Switch as free to play.
Ooh, that seems like it could control weird, but I mean, I'll try it out.
It's originally a mobile game.
Oh, okay. Okay, fair enough.
So that could be just fine.
The Switch needs more things, and it definitely could use some infinite hour things.
Did you know that the Nintendo is currently at a 9-year high for their stock price?
I mean, capitalize on it, guys. Make some games. Get some games out.
They got to get the roguelikes out. That's what they got to get. They got to get Enter the Gungeon on there. Also, Monster Hunter, man. That's an infinite hour game.
You know what they really need? Forget all that stuff. They need that one game. What the hell is it? Well, they need Hollow Knight for sure.
That's coming, yeah. And when it does come, I've heard some people talking about Hollow Knight recently, saying like, oh, they're adding all this expansion content. I wish that it were in the core game. I don't think I'm going to go back to the game, but it seems really cool that they're releasing all this content. And the Switch version is going to have all that stuff ready for you. So when you play Hollow Knight, you're going to be playing the full and complete version.
I want Dead Cells.
Yeah, that could be cool, but that won't release early access on Switch. I can see that coming out for multiple things once it's ready. I will say I think the Switch is in a pretty good spot, though. Even with just Breath of the Wild and Odyssey this year, like for first-party games. I mean, there were other first-party games. There were people who cared a lot if that Mario Kart came out or stuff like that. Splatoon is a big one. I like Splatoon a lot. It's a pretty good first year. Especially considering that most consoles have not very good first years. I just hope they can keep up the momentum. Like, they drop a Zelda and they drop a Mario in the first year. So does that mean that they're not, that like we don't usually get multiple of those per console generation? I hope that maybe there's like a Super Mario Odyssey 2 that's, you know, akin in quality to like a Super Mario Galaxy 2.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
I want to see another Zelda thing.
I want to see Mario. I want to see Monster Hunter on the Switch.
That would work.
For the West.
That would work.
Those are games, Ryan.
What about, what, Double Cross or whatever?
Yeah. Bring it to the West. Translate it to English.
Yeah.
The game's already made. Half the game is already translated. Literally, over half the game is translated. Just translate the last half of the game and bring it to the West.
Fair enough.
And that's what I think. It would probably be more well-received than Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite.
Oh, my God.
People don't seem to like that one.
Oh, my God.
Is that the deal?
Oh, let it be. Let it be.
This has been WTDG Podcast. You can find us online at WTDGpodcast.com, on iTunes at WTDG Podcast, or What's the Deal with Games, where you can rate, comment, and subscribe to the show. I missed one, didn't I? Internet, WTDGpodcast.com, Twitter at WTDG Podcast, iTunes. What's the Deal with Games,
where you can rate,
comment, and subscribe, all three of them.
A second time, thank you very much, Ryan Gowan, crying for the YouTube music. We use Revive as the intro and the outro off the new album, Beyond the Fleeting Gales. You can find them at the Run for Comic Cover Bandcamp. And it's time.
And Baby Makes 3, yeah.
And Baby Makes 3.